15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2.
This is Stand to Reason Radio. I'm Brett Kunkel, the Student Impact Director here at Stand to Reason, filling in for Greg, who is down under this week, doing some work with Summit Ministries in Australia. We've got two great hours of radio ahead of us. The second hour, we'll be taking your calls, but this first hour, I have a special guest, Frank Turek, who co-authored the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Now, I'm going to get right to Frank, but before I do, I would be remiss. No, actually, I would be in trouble if I didn't take care of one order of business here. There's a very special girl out there who this very day turns 5 years old, and that is my daughter, Paige. And Paige, I know you're listening right now, and yesterday we celebrated her fifth birthday at Libby Lou in downtown Disney. Now, if you're a parent and you know anything about Libby Lou, you know I was surrounded by little girls doing their hair and makeup. And but Paige, I want to say happy birthday to you, and I love you. And I expect that you'll listen to the rest of this show when I get home. I do want a summary of the show, okay? So happy birthday, Paige. Well, let's I got that out of the way. Had to take care of that. Let's get right to Frank Turek, who's our guest this first hour. Frank is the president of Impact Apologetics. He holds two master's degrees and a doctorate in apologetics. He speaks at university campuses, conferences. He's churches around the nation. Has appeared on shows like The O'Reilly Factor, Politically Incorrect, Faith Under Fire. He's written a couple great books. I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, as I mentioned, and also Legislating Morality. Frank, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Brett. Happy birthday, Paige.
Hey, Frank is going to be our special guest tomorrow night at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach to kick off our master series in Christian thought. And the talk is actually entitled the same title as his book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. And Frank, you and I met this past August at Focus on the Family. And we got to share some great dinner and some conversation. In fact, I remember that dinner we had with some great guys, if you remember that, in August. It was Lee Strobel and Sean McDowell and Alex McFarland. That was the first time I got to interact with you, Frank, and it was just really impressed with you. Now, Frank, I was curious. I don't think in that conversation we ever got into some of your background. I'm curious, how did you become an apologist?
Well, I originally came to faith by reading Josh McDowell books like Evidence Demands a Verdict and More Than a Carpenter, and I was very interested in apologetics after I got out of the Navy, and I happened to, by God's providence, run into Norman Geisler, who stayed at my house during a seminar that he was teaching that I happened to be attending. And at that time, he had just begun the seminary down in Charlotte, North Carolina, called Southern Evangelical Seminary, and it's really centered on apologetics, and he basically invited me to come down and check it out. This is back in 1993. And so my wife and I moved down to Charlotte in 93 and got a doctorate from Southern Evangelical Seminary and wrote a couple of books with Dr. Geisler. And so that's really how I got into it.
Now, did you grow up in a Christian home?
I grew up in a Catholic home. I went to Catholic high school. But I never really understood who Jesus was until I got into the Navy and had a roommate who was the son of a Methodist minister. And we actually went to a Baptist church. It happened to be in Pensacola, Florida, when I was going to flight school in Florida. And the Baptist service was unique to me because it was mostly preaching, and I had never experienced that before, and I just loved it because I wanted to learn.
Yeah. Now, Frank, with your work right now, I know now you've been on were you on staff at Southern?
No, every once in a while I teach a course over there, but no, I just write and I do seminars at churches, like I'll do one tomorrow night. And we've just started a new ministry called crossexamined.org, that's with a D, crossexamined.org, to go to colleges and universities because, as you know, Brett, 75% of our young people who are in the church through their teenage years, walk away from the church when they walk out of the home. In other words, 3 out of every 4 people in your youth group, if they're an average youth group, will walk away when they walk out of the home, and largely one of the major reasons is because they're intellectually skeptical. They get into a college campus, they get out in life, and they wind up listening to what the atheists and the liberals have to say, who dominate academia, as you know, and they have no defense for it. They're just defenseless because we have not equipped in our churches, we have not equipped our people with the truth about Christianity. We've told them that it's true, but not why.
And so that's kind of been the motivation for this kind of new project, right, Cross Examine.
Yes.
Now, is that linked with your other organization, Impact Apologetics?
Yeah, Impact Apologetics provides it's a website. ImpactApologetics.com is a website of a number of apologetic products, books, tapes, videos, PowerPoints, that kind of thing, DVDs. Cross-Examined is linked to that, but Cross-Examined is a nonprofit because we don't charge kids on a college campus. We just show up and do the seminar, and it's for free, so we have to, you know, raise money to do that. But Cross-Examined is a for-profit business.
Yeah, and I want to spend some time.
I mean, Impact Apologetics is a for-profit business.
Yeah, I want to spend some time talking with you a little bit about kind of young people and where they're at, because that's, of course, a passion for me,
yeah.
Kind of focusing on students here at Stand to Reason. But I want to talk a little bit about your talk tomorrow night and kind mm-hmm. of the I don't have enough faith to be an atheist.
Yeah, neither do I.
Well, now, yeah, Frank, here's how the atheist is going to look at you quizzically, and they're going to say, what are you talking about, Frank? Atheists don't exercise faith. We're not about faith. What are you talking about in your title there?
Sure. Well, it's a kind of a counterintuitive title because you always think that it's just religious people who have faith, but everybody's religious. If we define religion as some sort of explanation for ultimate reality, and all I'm saying is that you've got a certain amount of evidence for your worldview and a certain amount of faith. What you can't show with evidence, you have to take by faith. And I'm saying that the Christian worldview, Christianity, has a lot more evidence than the atheistic worldview. And so you only need a little bit of faith to believe in Christianity. You need a lot of faith to believe in atheism.
Okay, so you're not saying that there's somehow these kind of polar opposites, evidence and faith, and if you don't have enough evidence, then that's when you exercise faith.
No, I'm saying is that for every worldview, you have to have some amount of faith because you're not all-knowing. You know, you're basing your conclusion on some degree of probability. And I think the evidence is very strong in favor of Christianity. Am I absolutely 100% sure that Christianity is true? No. But I'm sure beyond a reasonable doubt. And when you look at all the evidence for Christianity, which we point out in the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, we see that the evidence is true or is strong enough to say I'm certain of it beyond a reasonable doubt. Where atheists, you know, the atheist arguments that I read, like Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris or Christopher Hitchens, their arguments are completely vacuous. I see very little merit in what they say.
Mm-hmm. Now, with this issue of faith, I think there's with these guys and with kind of your typical atheists, there's probably some confusion mm-hmm. That they're going to have when it comes to faith. They're going to take faith as oftentimes Christians communicate it, as some blind leap.
No.
So for them, so yeah. maybe with the atheists, we can say, hey, well, look, everyone trusts in something. You trust
right.
in what you have good reasons mm-hmm. to believe is true, and I do the same thing.
Sure.
And so that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about some blind leap because the atheist is going to say, well, no, I base my position on evidence, and I've
right.
got, you know, I've got the goods. And now you already mentioned have been called the new atheists, guys mm-hmm. like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris mm-hmm. and Daniel Dennett and these guys.
And the old atheists aren't much better in their arguments either.
Well, I would agree with you. Now, there seems to be a lot of attention that these guys are getting. And here's my question. I think the question of some Christians, and as I read articles and people who are kind of beginning or addressing this, are the new atheists really that big of a deal? I mean, should we be concerned?
Well, I think you should be concerned because the church is so unequipped to deal with anybody, much less the new atheists. I think if you're equipped with good apologetic material that Stand to Reason is known for, and you go to SDR.org, you'll get great apologetic material there. If you're equipped with that kind of material, the new atheists, you shouldn't worry about. The problem is the new atheists are very persuasive to people who are unequipped, which is most of the church.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the kind of what motivates the concern here is not just not that there's these new powerful arguments that are being marshaled.
No, it's just the fact that we as a church are unequipped to deal with them because we don't know the good arguments that back up Christianity so well.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, for the person in the pew, for that Christian who's not involved in the academic world, maybe like you or I, or doesn't have maybe as much time to kind of delve into study as you and I, it may seem a little overwhelming because there's such a breadth of issues that these guys are raising. In fact, what are, as you read these guys and as you interact with atheism, what are some of the key issues that they are and objections that they're raising that we need to be able to address?
Their primary issue is that Christianity is immoral, or that Christians have been immoral. Well, first of all, that doesn't disprove Christianity. Even if we grant them that Christians have done immoral things, that doesn't mean Christianity is false. Secondly, how do they get this idea of moral and immoral without an objective standard beyond themselves? Mm-hmm. I mean, if we're just a bunch of glorified chemicals, if we're just chemicals on a periodic table and there's nothing beyond that, then you can't say Mother Teresa was better than Hitler, because there is no good, bad, or better or worse if there is no immaterial standard of morality. We're just chemicals reacting. So they borrow from the Christian worldview in order to argue against it. So their entire argument borrows. Their entire case is they borrow from us in order to argue against us. They're like sawing off the limb upon which they sit.
Well, now, what would you say, Frank, to an atheist who says, no, we ground our morality? You know, I've talked to atheists who say, no, I hold that there is an objective moral law out there. I just ground it in human nature. Whereas you Christians may ground it in God.
There is no human. Who's human nature? Hitler's or Mother Teresa's? I mean, what do they mean by human nature? That they believe, to be a consistent atheist, you have to believe that there's nothing but the periodic table worth of elements. There's nothing but material. How can there be an objective, immaterial standard if we're nothing but the elements on a periodic table?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can't be. They're materialists. And get this. I mean, morality is one thing they harp on, but then you go to a guy like Richard Dawkins, and when he tries to give you an answer for the argument or an answer for where the universe came from, you know what his answer is? And I'm not making this up. Go to the God Delusion and look in the center of his book where he says, this is the heart of my book. You know what his answer is to how this universe came into existence out of nothing? Luck. Luck! This guy's supposed to be a scientist. Luck! What? I'm not making it up.
Yeah, I mean, you can go to the.
In fact, I'm looking for it right now. I just pulled the book off the shelf. Keep talking, I'll find it.
Now there are some other fronts, it seems to me, in this battle. You've got, of course, you've got the claims that Christians are immoral. You've got objections to just God's existence, kind of in general. But you've also, it seems, claims regarding the Bible, mm-hmm. its reliability. Mm-hmm. That they're throwing out.
Well, here's what we do, and I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. In the book and in the seminar, which we'll do tomorrow night, the book goes through 12 points that show why Christianity is true, and we start with truth. Does truth exist? And then we argue right through the existence of God, and then we argue about miracles, and then we give evidence that the New Testament is reliable, and ultimately you wind up at the bottom line that the New Testament, or I should say that the Bible, is the Word of God. Now, in the seminar, we divide those 12 points into four, and here are the four points we'll touch on tomorrow night. Does truth exist? Does God exist? Are miracles possible? And is the New Testament reliable? If truth exists, God exists, miracles are possible, then we can see if the New Testament's reliable, and if it is, then Christianity necessarily follows. So you can sort of step through the mess of all these issues out there by just proving Christianity is true. And if it's true, then you can deal with all these other side issues that the atheists bring up.
Mm-hmm. Now, on your typical college campus, you certainly need to deal with the issue of truth. Now, have you found, Frank, that dealing with atheists, that you really – do you start with some common ground there on truth? Because it seems like you've got a kind of a larger – so, you know, sometimes called a postmodern culture, where there's kind of views of truth that are relative. With atheists, it seems like you're dealing with guys who are kind of good old fashioned modernists.
Yeah.
And maybe there's some common ground there when it comes to truth. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, we deal with the truth issue up front because you hear this all the time. You know, you can't know truth, or it's true for you but not for me, or there is no truth, and we just turn it on itself. And we say, if there is no truth, how do you know that's true? You know, or you'd say, is that true? Or if somebody says it's true for you but not for me, say to them, oh, sure, go try that with your bank teller. You know, go to your bank teller one day and say, I'd like $5,000 out of my account. The bank teller says, I'm sorry, sir, you only have $27.06 in your account. You go, ha, that's true for you but not for me. Give me the $5,000. That's not the way the world works. Truth exists. You can know it. And if you can know it, then you can move on to God. But your point, Brett, is this. We hear a lot about postmodernism, but I agree with you. On the college campus and in life in general, most people are modernists. They believe in science. They believe there is truth, and only science can reveal it. And so we get right into the realm with them, and using scientific evidence show that this universe exploded into being out of nothing. So there must be something outside the universe that's immaterial, that's eternal, that's powerful, that's intelligent, that's personal, that's moral, that brought it into existence.
Mm-hmm. Now, Frank, have you had any opportunities to engage the new atheists at all?
Not one-on-one, not personally, although a friend of mine, Dinesh D'Souza, has, and I don't know if you've seen Dinesh's debate with Christopher Hitchens.
I haven't seen that debate. I actually took a group of high school seniors up to see D'Souza debate Michael Shermer up in Pasadena in December. But you actually have interacted with other atheists. In fact, as I was kind of doing some research for the show, you've done some debates with Richard Carrier.
A discussion with Richard Carrier online, and Richard Carrier is brilliant. But it was interesting in our little discussion. He admitted that miracles are possible, and it was very strange to me that he would admit that if he's an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he just threw that in or what, but
mm-hmm. It is a materialist way.
Yeah, I didn't get him. He's a very strange character. He has a very ad hoc approach to the New Testament. He's a brilliant guy, though, and so he talks a lot, and you're like, where's this guy coming from?
Yeah, I've actually been able to I've met Carrier actually mm-hmm. in the last couple of years here, as we've done some unique things here at Stand to Reason with young people. We've taken them on trips, mission trips.
Oh, yeah?
We call them apologetic mission trips,
uh-huh.
where we've gone up to Berkeley and engaged with atheists, really kind of go to the den, so to speak, and engage these guys. But Richard Carrier is one of the guys we've had come out and actually talk to our high school students.
He's very articulate.
He is. But you do see he smuggles in a lot he smuggles in the Christian worldview. He's a guy who wants to hold to objective morality and try and ground that.
Well, you know, and so much of the of debates are really the skill sometimes of the debater. And Christopher Hitchens is a great debater. I mean, he is a brilliant guy. But if you look at the debate he had with Dinesh, I think Dinesh got the best of him in that debate. And of course, Dinesh has the truth on his side. But mm-hmm. you can see it on YouTube. By the way, before I forget, page 158 of the God Delusion. Point 5 is where Dawkins says that he has no idea how the universe came into existence, basically, and makes heavier demands on luck. Page 158 of the God Delusion.
Page 158.
I'm not making this up, so your readers can go out there, your listeners can go out there and get the book and see what the most well-known atheist in the world right now is saying about how the universe came into existence.
I'm talking with Frank Turek, author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, which you co-authored with Norm Geisler. And, Frank, why don't you give us a quick plug for your website?
Yeah, the website is crossexamined.org, crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org. And you can link there to our other website, which has our books, tapes, and videos.
And I'll talk more with Frank after this break. You're listening to Stand to Reason.
Human suffering poses the most difficult question anyone can ask about a God who is both good and powerful. Do you know how to respond to the presence of evil and suffering in the world? Are you struggling with this question personally and need some clear thinking on the issue? Are you doubting God's goodness or know someone that is? Let Greg help you think through this important question. Order the tape set, Three Tough Questions from Stand to Reason. You'll also get Greg's training on two other questions that many struggle with today, the heathen and the unknown God, and is one way the only way? You'll be equipped to answer three of the toughest questions leveled against Christianity by the time you've thoroughly gone through this material. Extensive notes are included for your study. Order today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or by visiting our website at www.str.org.
Tired of defending your faith with, "The Bible says so," "does too," or "I think it does"? Do you remove yourself from conversations with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Stop being unprepared and call today for the latest issue of Solid Ground, the bi-monthly newsletter of Stand to Reason. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you articulate your faith and have a biblically grounded understanding of subjects like same-sex marriage, evolution, stem cell research, and partial birth abortion. Don't be embarrassed or unprepared when you stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kogel teaches you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive yet effective manner. Learn tactics tempered with wisdom that make your beliefs persuasive, not naive. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Ask for the latest copy of Solid Ground to be sent to you today. It's free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
You are listening to Stand to Reason. I'm Brett Kunkel, sitting in for Greg, who is in Australia this week doing some work with Summit Ministries. And we are talking with Frank Turek, who is going to be kicking off our Master Series in Christian Thought, which begins tomorrow night, runs five consecutive weeks. Frank kicks it off with a lecture tomorrow night entitled, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. And the next week, Dr. Paul Meyer will be doing a talk on Christ or Caricature, New Evidence from History and Archaeology. Dan Kimball follows up with They Like Jesus But Not the Church. Dr. Fred Sanders from Biola will be talking about drawing proper boundaries for orthodoxy. And then Greg will be concluding the series with his talk on the new atheist. And so we've got a great series. I would encourage you to make it a priority to be there. I mean, this is an opportunity for you to get exposure to some great Christian minds. It all starts tomorrow night, 7 to 9:30 at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. And if you go to our website, str.org, on the homepage on the left-hand side, you'll find a link that will give you all the information for our Master Series in Christian Thought. Frank Turek, author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, is joining me this first hour. And in fact, Frank, you know, I actually had a dream about you last night.
Uh-oh.
I was online looking at some video clips of you doing the Politically Incorrect show with Bill Maher, and I watched two clips of that. And that
right.
that was probably a number of years ago, right?
Yeah.
Maher's
show was probably in like 2001 maybe.
Yeah, and you were on there, and of course, as I'm watching Maher interact with you and your arguments. I'm getting frustrated. I'm talking to my computer, saying, "You know, what's going on here?" But and then right after that, I went to bed. So I think I had these images
did I win the debate with Maher in your dream?
Yeah, actually, I think it turned to violence or something like
that.
Oh,
it did. Well, it didn't turn to violence, but you can see that on YouTube. Somebody put it up on YouTube. You can see a couple of segments of it. Yeah, that's always a fun venue, or it was, because it was always four against one, and you always had like at least one comedian on there. So I think Paul Rodriguez was on there.
He's
cracking jokes between serious arguments against abortion, you know?
That was a little maddening because he started to get serious, and then he's cracking a joke
mm-hmm.
But yeah, you can go to YouTube and find those. Now, you mentioned Dinesh D'Souza is a friend of yours and his debate with Hitchens.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen the debate myself, but I heard that Dinesh, and I think – I'm not sure if he does this in his book, but he kind of – he seems to sell the farm kind of epistemologically, so to speak, where he says, look, we as Christians, we've got our faith, and it's kind of at the end of the day, it's a matter of faith. And he kind of – he does the same thing with the atheists, is this is a matter of faith for you.
Yeah, I'm kind of halfway through the book now, so I haven't read the whole – you mean his What's So Great About Christianity book?
Yeah, well, yeah. I think I heard that he had done that kind of in his debate with Hitchens, and he did that when I saw him in his debate with Shermer do the same kind of thing where he says, well, look, it's a matter of faith. At the end of the day, it's a matter of faith for us as Christians.
Well, if he said that, I wouldn't agree with that. I mean, it is a matter of faith to a certain degree, but it's a bigger matter of faith for them because they have far less evidence than we do.
Yeah, in fact, I'm recalling how he put it. He said, we leap in one direction, but then he also puts that kind of in the atheist lap and says, you leap in the other direction, but it's actually a leap of faith for both of us.
No, I wouldn't agree with that. I think he may not totally understand the refutation of Kant,
mm-hmm.
Which he goes into in his book. I don't know. I think he kind of buys into to Kant's philosophy, and we deal with that. And I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. That Kant's philosophy that you can't know the real world is self-defeating, because
mm-hmm.
how would you know a real world if you say you can't know it? So, it Kant's philosophy does not lock us into agnosticism. I don't know if Dinesh has thought that through quite a bit, but overall, most of his book, what I've read, is good. He's a little bit too much on the Darwinist side for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But other than that, it's been a pretty good read. It's a pretty good history book because he goes through a lot of the historical things that I think have become actually mythological or... you know, he talks about the whole Galileo and the Copernicus thing, and there's been a lot of myth that's grown up around it, I should say, that we don't realize. Salem witch trials and all that. He does a good job with all that.
Yeah, he's real strong there. In fact, and he's also a great, great communicator. And,
Oh, he came and spoke here in Charlotte at our SES conference, and he was fabulous.
Yeah,
he did a great job.
Yeah.
So he's on our side most of the way.
Yeah, I agree. Now, before the break, you were talking about kind of your approach and kind of what you'll be talking about tomorrow night in terms of kind of the progression for you is truth, God's existence, miracles, and the Bible as the Word of God. Would you talk us through a little bit with the logical connections there that you see? Kind of make that explicit for our listeners.
Okay, for truth, if we buy into what the culture says today, that there is no truth, or it's just true for you but not for me, then you can't say the Bible's true and it's true for everybody. And so we have to deal with truth first. That's our refutation of postmodernism. We kind of have a fun way of doing that, as most of your listeners, if they can show up tomorrow night, we'll see at the Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. By the way, we can take questions during that event tomorrow night. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, all right, good. So we deal with truth first, and then we move on to God. We give three arguments for the existence of God, three sets of evidences, the cosmological, teleological, and moral arguments from the beginning of the universe, design of the universe and life, and the moral argument. And so we show that there's a being out there that created this universe out of nothing, designed it just so, designed life, put a moral imperative on us, has an objective moral law, and we can arrive at all that without ever cracking the Bible, Brett. We can know that there's an infinite, immaterial, eternal, timeless, powerful, personal, moral being out there that brought this universe into existence. And you don't need the Bible to know that. It's congruent with the Bible, but you don't need the Bible to know it. After that, we move into the question of miracles. Are miracles possible? And we show that not only are miracles possible, the greatest miracle of all has already occurred. And, of course, the greatest miracle of all in the Bible is the first verse. If Genesis 1:1 is true, then every other verse is believable. So we point out that not only are miracles possible, the greatest miracle of all has already occurred, and we have scientific evidence for it. Even atheistic scientists are saying, look, looks like the universe exploded into being out of nothing. Now, they don't draw the same implication that we do, but it's pretty strong evidence that there must be a being out there that did this. Then we move into the New Testament. Is it reliable? Only can the New Testament be reliable and true if truth exists, God exists, and miracles are possible. Because God can't have a word if there is no God. So you have to establish God first.
Yeah. And now you've got your kind of your positive case laid out there, and we talked about a little bit about one of the key objections that we're hearing from these guys, the new atheists. Is that Christians are immoral. But what are some of the other key areas that you hear these guys kind of attacking?
Well, that's the primary thing, is that our behavior hasn't lived up to the behavior of Christ, to which I reply, yeah, that's why we need a Savior. You know, we're all fallen. I mean, the church is a hospital for sinners. It's not a country club for saints. So, I mean, we're fallen. We're a fallen race. The human race, and that's why Christ had to come. The other thing they try and hit on is Darwinism. And you know what? And D'Souza talks about this a little bit. He says even if Darwinism is completely true, the atheists can't explain where the universe came from, can't explain where the first life came from, and they're trying to explain where subsequent life came from. So they're a long way. Their worldview is a long way from being valid, even if Darwinism is true. But it's not true. I mean, the evidence is so weak for Darwinism, and there's counter evidence against it. We have two chapters, and I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, which deal with that. So we kind of blunt that criticism right up front. Lee Strobel's book, Case for Creator, is a great book, too, on that issue. Mm-hmm. And there are several books, as you know, on Darwinism. So they really try and apply Darwinism to everything. You know, Darwinism is applied to morality. It's applied not only to biology, but morality, but to sociology, to anthropology, to psychology, to everything. Darwinism everywhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it is an inadequate system, even for subsequent even for subsequent life forms, much less where the first life form came from, much less where the universe came from. So it falls way short, even if they're true, even if they're right about Darwinism.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you respond? So some of these guys, well, as we've been interacting, as I've been interacting with some of the atheists up in the Bay Area and mm-hmm. some of the organizations up there, and guys like Carrier, some of these guys are actually trying to make arguments that Jesus never existed. Now, I can't recall if some of the new atheists are actually. I think some of them, maybe it's Hitchens who I think makes that case a little bit in God is not great. But have you come across that as kind of a main?
Well, I pressed Carrier on that a little bit, but he kind of backed off it. I mean, there's no serious scholarship out there which thinks Jesus doesn't exist or didn't exist. I mean, where did Josephus? Why did Josephus talk about him then? I mean, there are several references. There are 10 references to Christ outside the New Testament within 150 years of his life. I'm not talking about the early church fathers. I'm talking about, you know, Suetonius and Tacitus and Josephus and these types of people. Even the Jewish Talmud mentions Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if he never existed, why are all these non-Christian sources mentioning him?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and one thing I've noticed about these guys is that their conclusions don't follow from their arguments. I mean, they'll cast doubt on the New Testament and kind of point out all the contradictions, alleged contradictions.
A la Bart Ehrman.
Yeah, right. and then want to argue that, well, therefore we've got this book that's highly unreliable, and therefore Jesus never existed. But that doesn't even follow. Even if the New Testament was full of error, it doesn't therefore follow that Jesus never existed.
No, it's like saying there's some wrong numbers in the phone book, but you can't trust it for most of the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Now,
so what?
Yeah, now,
you know? So there are no phones. Because there are some wrong numbers in the phone book, there are no phones.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it doesn't follow. You're right.
Yeah, it's a non sequitur.
Uh-huh.
Now, Hitchens claims that nothing historical is known about Christ, or virtually nothing historical is known about Christ. How do you respond to something like that?
Well, where do I start? First thing I think you have to point out is that the New Testament documents were written early, and I think they're written all prior to 70 A.D., Now, why do I say that? Well, there's no mention of the most dramatic event in Jewish history in the New Testament documents, mm-hmm. except for Jesus predicting it, and that's the destruction of the temple and the city in 70 A.D.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's draw an analogy. Let's suppose you were reading a book about the history of southern Manhattan or New York City, and it talks about the World Trade Towers being built in the 70s, but it makes no mention of those towers being destroyed by Muslim terrorists on 9/11. When would you assume that book was written?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, before that.
Obviously, prior to that. And so it seems to me that these documents were written prior to 70 A.D. because they make no mention of one of the greatest events in Jewish history. It wasn't. I mean, 9/11 was dramatic to our country, but I mean, 70 A.D. was far beyond anything that 9/11 did to our country. I mean, they lost their entire country. They lost millions. I think Josephus, the estimate was a million of the Jews were killed. He called it the greatest war of all time. And it's not just an argument from silence either, because there are New Testament books, even John and Revelation, which are written as if the temple is still standing while they're writing
mm-hmm.
the book. And I think if you look at Colin Hemmer's work on Acts in the Setting of Hellenistic History, which we quote extensively in I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, that Acts had to be written by 62 A.D. There are 84 details, Brett, and we list this all in Chapter 10 of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, 84 details, eyewitness details from Chapter 13 of the Book of Acts to the end of the book, Chapter 28, eyewitness details, obscure things like who was the obscure ruler in a very small town on a coastal town in the Mediterranean? What was the strange language spoken there? What was the wind direction at a particular part of the Mediterranean at a particular time of the year? Luke even has the depth of the water off Malta right when they run aground in Malta in Acts chapter 27.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why would he have all this right and then lie about miracles, which he also records in that narrative? Why would he put in all these accurate, trivial details and then lie about miracles. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense. And the way we know it's written by 62 A.D., because it does not record Paul's death, it does not record Peter's death, it does not record James's death. It does record, however, the death of Stephen and the death of James, the half-brother of John, in Acts chapter 12, but it doesn't record the deaths of its two main characters. Now, when would you assume, if you're reading, say, a book about Martin Luther King, when would you assume the book was written if the book ends and he hasn't been assassinated?
Yeah, absolutely.
Got to be prior to, you know, to his death.
Yeah. So, I don't think these guys like Hitchens, the new atheists, are I'm not sure what they do with, I mean, if they're going to cast this kind of doubt on the historical reliability of the New Testament, what are they going to do with any ancient document?
Well, you know why they do, though, and we point this out in the book as well. It's because the New Testament has miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you have to establish God and miracles before you look at the New Testament, because the New Testament's incredible if there is no God and miracles are not possible. So
yeah.
you have to get those two steps out of the way before you go to the New Testament.
They're operating on these kind of Darwinian assumptions. Now, what's the evidence that's so persuasive for guys like Hitchens?
Well, you know, I can't read his heart, but as we point out in the book, a lot of times atheism is not a intellectual problem; it's a volitional problem. In other words, a lot of people aren't Christians it's because they don't want to be Christians,
mm-hmm.
because they've been wronged by a Christian. And if you look at Hitchens, sometimes I think the first A in atheist ought to stand for angry,
mm-hmm.
because atheists are often angry, and Hitchens is actually angry that God is his superior. If you look at his debate with D'Souza, he even says this. It's a moral outrage that we would somehow be under the sovereignty of God,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Now, would we be guilty of kind of the genetic fallacy if we go right to that issue? Or do these guys make kind of a case for Darwinism, or are they just kind of assuming it?
Well, the case that I think they make is very weak, mm-hmm. and if you look at Dawkins, who is a zoologist and, you know, supposed to have some expertise in this area, just assumes Darwinism is true. He
mm-hmm.
doesn't give you any real evidence that it's true.
Mm-hmm. This is just fact. It's self-evident to
right.
everyone.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the whole point about, and I blog on this on crossexamine.org, the fact that atheists have no way out but Christians do. Here's what I say. Atheist Christopher Hitchens is morally outraged with the Christian belief that God created us and put us under him without our consent. But as John Piper actually wrote on this, he points out that even if God does not exist, we are still here without our consent.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that true?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, even if we're just governed by natural laws, we're here without our consent. So the moral outrage is completely misplaced anyway.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm with you on, you know, this being a volitional problem.
Right.
I want to make sure that we're careful to kind of go through it. Look, do these guys make a case for their Darwinism and deal with that, or point out that, hey, look, it seems like they simply assume this, give the counter evidence, but then at the end of the day, I think we can make a strong case that that actually atheists fit kind of a tight control group when it comes to they talk about believers who need a crutch. But maybe you're familiar with the work of Paul Vitz,
uh-huh.
the psychologist. I think he was at New York University. I don't know if he's still there, but he wrote the book Faith of the Fatherless,
yeah.
where he makes the argument that, look, you assess the lives of these atheists who indeed have many of these. And, of course, there's a few exceptions, but in general, they fit this kind of tight control group where there's an absent father, a dead father, or an abusive father. And, in fact, I've
right.
kind of been taking my own poll here in the last couple of years when we've gone to Berkeley and interacted with atheists. And as I've gotten to know these guys and tried to strike up a friendship with them, you know, I find out a little bit about them. And so far, almost every single one that I've interacted with or that we've had come speak to our groups
uh-huh.
have actually shared at some point that there's been kind of a somewhat broken relationship with a father, not a very good home life. And
Well, you know, Christianity is not a crutch. It's a stretcher, because you can't limp into heaven without it. I'll admit it. It's a stretcher for me, because I'm not going anywhere unless Christianity is true. But I don't believe in the stretcher without good evidence.
Mm.
And back to your point about Darwinism. as I said, even if Darwinism is true, there are so many other things they can't explain. And a good worldview must be able to explain, for example, here's what atheists can't explain. They can't explain the origin of the universe out of nothing. They can't explain the design of the universe. They can't explain the origin of the four natural forces. They can't explain the origin of the laws of logic, the laws of mathematics, the laws of causality, the laws of objective morality and human rights. They can't explain the origin and design of life. They can't explain the origin of intelligence, the origin of personality, the origin of love and beauty. Outside of that, it's a great theory. You see, what we do, Brett, so often is we get down in the weeds with them on Darwinism, when in fact they can't explain where the weeds came from. They can't explain where the earth came from. They can't explain how the weeds were watered. They can't explain how the sky and the cloud, they can't explain any of this. And we're down here at the weeds granting them all these other things that they need to explain and haven't been able to do so.
Yeah, yeah. I am talking with Frank Turek, author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, and our special guest speaker tomorrow night at the Master Series in Christian Thought in Hermosa Beach at Hope Chapel. Hope to see you there. Frank's obviously a passionate guy, and I think you're going to enjoy his presentation. We'll have more with Frank after the break. This is Stand to Reason.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel, letting you know that Stand to Reason is back with an unmatched cruise conference experience featuring some of the top Christian thinkers in the country. On August 2nd, 2008, we'll set sail from Vancouver, BC for 8 days aboard one of Holland America's finest cruise ships. We're planning a voyage you'll never forget. It's specifically designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. Here's our plan. We want to challenge you with thoughtful presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction and fellowship with expert speakers and fellow passengers. Add to that the stunning splendor of the Alaskan coastline and a 7-day itinerary that includes Glacier Bay, Skagway, Juneau, and Ketchikan. I'll be joined by some of our distinguished guest speakers, Josh McDowell, J.P. Moreland, and Sean McDowell. Come and join Stand to Reason and our lineup of speakers for a memorable spiritual adventure. You'll enjoy plenty of fun and relaxation, along with ample opportunity to meet our speakers, ask questions, and enjoy each other's company. Listen, if studying Christian subjects with some of the sharpest minds on the planet in the fellowship of other believers of kindred spirit aboard a beautiful ship sailing the Alaskan coastline sounds like your idea of a perfect vacation, then this is the trip for you. As always, you don't need any prior understanding of the subject matter. Simply bring it desire to learn in a relaxing environment. We planned everything about this trip with your enjoyment and your enrichment in mind. But don't just take my word for it. Visit str.org and see what other guests of Stand to Reason have said about past STR cruises. Save the dates, download the brochure from str.org, and then contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. They're helping us with our trip, and their skilled staff are committed to answering all your questions. I look forward to seeing you on board.
I'm Brett Kunkel, and you are listening to Stand to Reason. I'm filling in for Greg, and actually this young, youthful music is an indication that Greg is out of town. and we've got a great Master Series tomorrow night. And in fact, Frank Turek, co-author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, is joining me this first hour, and he's kicking off our lecture series tomorrow night. Folks, the Master Series is a great opportunity for you to get some just first-class training in defending the faith, and also do it. We bring in speakers who don't just have this wealth of knowledge, but no personality or don't have experience in ministry. We've got folks that really have tough minds, but tender hearts, and so I'm looking forward to each one of these. We've got Frank Turek kicking it off, Dr. Meyer, Dan Kimball, Fred Sanders, and then Greg, of course, closing the series out. But go to our website and you get information on that. But we hope to see you there tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. Frank, you mentioned in the first segment a little bit about this new project, Cross Examined, and you talked a little bit about the problem that we see with young people And I don't know if there's a percentage of your work that you do with young people or if it's primarily with adults, But obviously, you've seen the problem.
Right.
And I've seen it too. And I think there's just a lot of evidence and studies that have come out lately. And I think are you referring, when you talk about 3 out of 4 young people leaving the church after they graduate from high school, is that the Lifeway study that you're referring to?
That is Lifeway and George Barna. Lifeway found 70%, George Barna found 75% of church youth.
Yeah. Now how does Cross Examined kind of address this problem?
What we're doing is we're going on college campuses, and also we're going to some high schools as well. And we're doing seminars on college campuses called "I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist." And as you can imagine, Brett, this attracts everybody from the atheist all the way to the Christian.
Yeah.
And
provocative title.
Right. We just did one up at Appalachian State here in just north of Charlotte a month or so ago, and we'll be going to about 7 or 8 of them this spring. They can go up to crossexamine.org if they want to contact us to bring us in. If any of your listeners want to bring us into a university, just go to the website and drop us an email. But what we do is we go in and we do the seminar, and we have Q&A, and we just try and show people that the most reasonable worldview is Christianity. Now, can we, you know, cover the waterfront in these seminars? No, but we go through the 4 points that we're going to go through tomorrow night: truth, God, miracles, and the New Testament. We leave behind the book. We're developing curriculum to leave behind. We recommend they go to the STR website as well and maybe get tactics for defending the faith. We just want people to know there are answers out there. So these Christians who are on campus and these seekers who are on campus know that there are good answers and that the most reasonable worldview to believe in is Christianity. And, you know, they think they're going to become real reasonable when they leave Christianity and adopt an atheistic or agnostic worldview, but they're actually becoming less reasonable.
Now, you say we, and of course, I know some of the others who are involved, but
sure.
Maybe inform our audience here. Who else is involved?
Yeah, well, STR is involved. You're involved. Greg's going to be involved, and myself and probably some other presenters from around the country. Lee Strobel, Josh McDowell will probably be at some of our special events, some of our bigger church events, because we're going to do these at churches as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they can go up to the website and see. We've got Alex McFarland. We've got a guy who runs allaboutgod.com who's a great guy. His name is Randall Niles. We've got some students and graduates of Southern Evangelical Seminary who have been graduates in apologetics. They have apologetic degrees, and there may be some folks out your way out in California that you can identify for. So we want to get a team of people who in coming years can blanket the country with these seminars, just to show that Christianity is reasonable, and we'll go into the lion's den and take the fight to the atheists and agnostics.
And I think that's one of the kind of exciting things, as I've come to learn more a little bit about your project here, is that you're really wanting to prepare a team,
that's right.
an army. It's not a lone ranger kind of thing.
No.
But, let's get this team together, and there's strength in numbers, and, kind of divide the country up here a little bit and really go after aggressively young people on the college campus. Now, in one sense, the project seems to be kind of a rescue mission for those Christians who are kind of on the college campus and are feeling a little overwhelmed by, all the objections that they're trying to deal with.
Oh, absolutely. It's a rescue mission, but it's also a search and rescue mission. It's not something where we're limiting who can go in. We're trying to rescue Christians, but we're inviting atheists. We're inviting agnostics. We're inviting anybody. We're professors. We had a professor at Appalachian State who was very hostile to Christianity before the seminar. I know because the student representative there told me about it. And after the seminar, he said, "That's some of the best evidence I've seen for God, and now I'm going to consider the claims of Christ," because we only went through the first 2 points in the first in the first night there. We went through truth and God. We're going to go back here next month to do miracles in the New Testament. So if you can get the professor on your side, then you can really impact the campus.
Yeah, and boy, talk about leveraged impact there.
Right.
If you can impact a professor who then in turn impacts students, that's powerful.
But you're right. It's not a Lone Ranger deal. We've got this summer we're going to be training the trainers, and next fall we're going to hopefully really hit the ground running. As I say, we're going to probably do anywhere between 8 and 10 events this spring, but this fall where we get the team up to speed, then we're going to be able to really get out there and hopefully do several of these and ultimately do 100 or more a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really like that idea of a team. And even within Christianity, we struggle with some of the kind of the celebrityism and so I like the idea of men and women kind of partnering together on this. Now, this is, like you said, it's kind of a search and rescue mission. Mm-hmm. But what can we do? And I don't know if you're doing anything in particular or have any focus on this, but what about being a little proactive and training our young people in the churches before we actually send them out? What suggestions will you have for someone who's a pastor or a leader in the church? How do we begin training our people?
Well, that's why we're developing a curriculum for I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. That's why everybody ought to get tactics for defending the faith and put their youth group through it as well from STR, as you know. And Lee Strobel has great books on this. I mean, this is not a turf issue. This is a kingdom issue. Mm-hmm. And so everybody, we got to get all hands on deck. We got to get the Lee Strobels of the world. We got to get your organization on board. We got to get Josh on board. We got to get Alex McFarland at Southern Evangelical Seminary on board. William Lane Craig. We got to get everybody on this problem, because this is a problem that if we keep losing 3 out of every 4, Christianity is going to be, as Josh McDowell wrote in a recent book, the last Christian generation in America.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you work on college campuses, what are the main questions students are asking?
Same questions. In fact, it's kind of funny. Our last event at App State, I've been talking about, we were getting questions from atheists, and I would put a PowerPoint slide up for it, and the atheists would go, "He's got a slide for this." Oh, you know what I mean? Because we can anticipate what they're going to ask. Uh-huh. They're going to ask, when you talk about the beginning of the universe, they're going to say, well, maybe this is a multiverse. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the things that Dawkins brings up. Like, we're just one of an infinite number a billion number of these multiple universes out there. Of course, they never come to think that, A, there's no evidence for that. B, if there are multiple universes out there, they need a designer and a creator, too. So yeah. It doesn't help them. But, they come up with those types of questions. And, we found that morality is a big issue on campus. I mean, when you talk about the moral argument, that's where you're going to get a lot of questions on the issue of morality.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and you find students just coming from a kind of a relative perspective?
Yeah, they come from a relative perspective, and here's what they confuse. And, in fact, Greg talked about this on a recent Stand to Reason show, the difference between ontology and epistemology. And what I mean by that is that the students will buy into Darwinism and say that, well, we know morality by our genes or by Darwinism or whatever. Morality evolved. Now, again, I don't believe this, but even if we were to grant them that, that does not tell us why something is wrong. It only tells us how we know it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's a difference. Knowing why something is wrong is something completely different than knowing knowing that it's wrong. The difference is ontology deals with that something is, and epistemology deals with how you know it. I know the times tables because my first grade teacher, Miss Santanello, taught them to me. But the times tables existed independent of me knowing them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people get that confused all the time. And Darwin is trying to say morality came via Darwinism. Even if that's true, it doesn't explain why murder's wrong. Why is murder wrong?
Yeah. And you see that confusion when you make the case for objective morality, and then the follow-up question is, well, how do you know your views are right, or how do you know which moral views are the right ones? And that, like you said, there's that confusion between metaphysics and epistemology.
Another great philosopher that I've mentioned Craig and Greg and these other guys, Josh and Lee out there, but another great guy is Jay Budziszewski from UT Austin, and he has a book called What We Can't Not Know. And he used to say, when people would say to him, "I don't believe in objective morality," he would try and argue them into objective morality. You know what he finally wound up doing? He wound up saying, "Now, do you have any real doubt that murder's wrong?" Mm-hmm. And the guy would typically go, "Well, no, I don't."
Yeah.
Okay, let's grant that. It is really wrong. We all know that. I don't need to try and persuade you of something that should be self-evident to you, do I?
Yeah, and that's when I've done some work out in Nebraska with a worldview organization out there, but we've tried to set up a debate on the issue of morality, because this is such a big question for young people on the college campuses, and we cannot get anyone to be an opponent to take up the side that morality is not objective, especially from the philosophy department.
Oh yeah,
they're too smart for that.
That's right. That's right. Well, it's a losing battle because everybody intuitively knows. I mean, that's the one argument you take with you all the time. It's written on your heart.
Mm.
You know, that God exists. It's right there.
Yeah.
You know, you can't run from it. Well, you can run from it, but you really can't deny it because it's written on your heart.
Well, hey, Frank, this hour has flown by. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. I am looking forward to tomorrow night and joining you for dinner and then the Master Series tomorrow night. Thanks for joining us on the phone, Frank, and we'll see you tomorrow night.
Well, thanks for having me, Brett. Thanks to Melinda for arranging this whole thing. The enforcer, I know, is listening. And
yeah,
happy birthday, Paige. And make sure you guys are there tomorrow night.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Tomorrow night, our Master Series in Christian Thought at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. Be there. Frank Turek, author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, will be doing a presentation of the same name. You're not going to want to miss it. That's it for our first hour, friends. Second hour, we've got open lines. So if you want to go ahead and get in the queue right now, you can do that. And we'll take your calls straight after this break. You're listening to Stand to Reason. You are listening to Stand to Reason. This is Brett Kunkel filling in for Greg, who is down under this week. In fact, I don't know if is it daytime there where he could be actually picking up the show? He could actually be listening right now. But we want to welcome you to the second hour. We've got open lines the second hour, and I want to encourage you to give us a call. Give us a piece of your mind, as Greg says. If you are from Orange County, if you were local here, give us a call at 714-754-4150. That's 714-754-4150. Or you can call toll-free if you're out of the area, 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. You can get in the queue here. Lines are pretty wide open right now. And get in the queue and ask any question you have about philosophy, morality, religion, values, ethics, and we'll chat. Before we get to our calls, I want to kind of take care of a little bit of business here and then talk a little bit, just follow up on my interview with Frank. Tomorrow night, the first hour, we had Frank Turek as our special guest, and he co-authored I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist with Norm Geisler, which is a great book. In fact, if you haven't read that book, I encourage you to read it. Very accessible, great for the layperson, the person who doesn't feel capable of maybe getting really really technical into some of these issues. It's a great introduction to Christian apologetics. I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. In fact, I suggest that book for young people who want to, you know, get into kind of a general defense of the faith. I suggest that book all the time. So Frank is kicking off our Master Series tomorrow night, 7 to 9:30. And then he'll be followed up by Dr. Paul Meyer, who will be looking at the evidence from history and archaeology for Christ. Dan Kimball will be doing a talk entitled They Like Jesus But Not the Church, Reaching the Emerging Culture While Remaining Orthodox. And I think that should be a very interesting and engaging talk, as Dan is a kind of a recognized leader in the emerging church. Fred Sanders, February 4th, will be talking about God in a Box, Drawing Proper Boundaries for Orthodoxy. And then on the 11th of February, Greg will be finishing things up by looking at The New Atheists. And I think the title is Old Arguments, New Attitude, Old Arguments, or something like that. But it'll be great to have kind of Frank and Greg kind of bookending the series with the topic of atheism, which, of course, is just getting a lot of press with these new atheists. And so you will not want to miss the Master Series. Also, I want to, let's see, announce our Frapper winner, although I am looking through my notes here and I cannot find my sheet of paper. It looks like Nick Thurmer. I think it's Nick Thurmer who is our Frapper winner this week, and Nick will be sending you out your prize, a free gift, for registering on our Frapper map. If you don't know what the Frapper map is all about, simply go to our website at str.org. And you will see our, on the homepage, you'll see our podcast icon. Just click on that and it'll bring up the Frapper map. And you can register and give us an idea of where people are listening from, where people are kind of at in, not only in the country, not only in the United States, but around the world. And, so go and register, and then we put you in a weekly drawing for, some free STR products. So congratulations to our Frapper winner this week. Now, I want to, before we take your calls and lines are open, we've got a couple lines open here. I want to encourage you to give us a call, 1-800-227-5278, 1-800-227-5278. If you're local here in Orange County, give us a call at 714-754-4150. I want to follow up a little bit on our discussion that we had that first hour with Frank Turek, and as we talk about the issue of atheism, and it really is we deal with just apologetic issues in general. Oftentimes, after a presentation or even during a presentation, there's always the question, kind of the question, how does this stuff practical, or how do we interact with these things or talk about these things outside of a lecture series like tomorrow night? How do these things play out in real life? Is there some practical things we can take away from this? And so I think that's always a challenge that we as apologists or those of us who kind of are in this field need to constantly be thinking about how do you get people to really engage in these kinds of things? And there's just been a few things that we've been doing here at Stand to Reason that I wanted to share with you, and maybe these can kind of be a springboard for you in terms of maybe thinking of some of your own ideas. I mean, are there ways that we can engage with atheism in our local church? Now, here's a couple things that we've done, and specifically that I've done with my work with young people, and actually with adults as well. But one of the things I've done is kind of create a presentation that I call kind of the atheist role play. And that's where a church or a youth group will invite me in. And oftentimes the way I'll be introduced to their students is as an atheist from a local college. And this kind of adds some intensity to the whole event where when a group of high school students thinks that I'm actually a real atheist from a local college or a university, this adds some kind of electricity to the air, if you will. And students will, of course, piques their interest and maybe get a better turnout. And I'll go, and basically what I'll do is I'll take about 10 minutes and I'll say, look, here are my five reasons why I'm not a Christian, and I'll take, kind of common atheistic arguments and kind of play those out for the students, and then I invite the students to engage and really force the students into into a situation where they have to defend their faith. And of course, those brave students will begin raising their hands and begin to engage. And it's an opportunity, as Frank mentioned, most of our young people, and not just our young people, But many of the folks in our churches are just not equipped to defend the faith. And that's why the new atheists are a concern, because we just have not done our job in terms of discipleship. I mean, I think apologetics is just an essential part of discipleship, especially given our cultural context. And so we'll do the atheist role play. And kind of just have at the students a little bit. And I tell you what, after we get warmed up, students then engage. And it's an opportunity for me, who is a little bit older, who's done some study in these areas, to kind of expose some of their ignorance and really help surface what we consider to be a real need, knowing what you believe and why you believe it, and make that become a kind of this explicit felt need in students. And so, you know, by the end of that time, and this is just the case in every youth group I've done this in so far, by the end of the time, students are kind of licking their wounds a little bit, and they realize they don't know much about the faith. They don't know how to defend it. And I've kind of dismantled them in a little bit. And then, of course, I reveal who I am. And I think actually this gives them some confidence. They get to see, hey, look, this guy's on our side actually, and he knows these arguments, so there must be some good answers if he's still a Christian. And but then after I tell students who I am, then I've got their ear, and I can look them in the eye and I can say, hey, you in a few short years you're going to college and you're going to encounter a real professor who's going to want to dismantle your Christianity, or you're going to encounter a real roommate and you're going to be in that dorm room one-on-one and he's going to be coming after you aggressively. What do you do in that situation if you aren't equipped to defend your faith? And I can look those students in the eye and say, hey, this is essential. You need to do this. And so that's one thing we've done. Also, I've talked about the Berkeley mission trip where I partnered with a church here in Southern California, the Rising Tide. And they basically said, hey, we want to do a different kind of mission trip. You know, we've done the Mexico mission trips, the trips where we go and we serve the poor, and those are great. But we want to do something that really equips our church and our young people to know what they believe and why they believe it and be able to defend it against, against atheism. And so we've gone up and put these trips together from scratch. And it's something really that anyone can do. In fact, and I've blogged on this. You can go to our blog and click on my name and see some posts there that I've kind of laid out carefully what we've done and who we've interacted with. And so if you want some more information on that, you can go to our blog at str.org and find out more about the Berkeley mission trips that we've done the last 2 years. But this year, we're doing something a little different. With the same church, with Rising Tide, we are going to be staying in Southern California and interacting now on a kind of a local basis. We've gone to Berkeley, 6 hours away from Southern California. The church now, we want to stay here in Southern California and begin interacting with those atheists who are in our very own community. And so what we're doing is trying to put together a number of some training events, and then some events to interact with atheists. And you're probably like me, where you don't have just a bunch of atheist friends that you're interacting with all the time. I want to minister to those who think that God does not exist, and ultimately maybe see them come to Christ. And so we're trying to make some connections in our local community. And so what we're doing is we're doing some training. The first thing we're going to do is we're doing training kind of with the church. We're doing a training retreat where we're going to get away for 2 days, a Friday and Saturday, and just go through the arguments and the objections and really kind of put the church through kind of a boot camp. But then in February, we've put together some various events. And the way that I've kind of come up with this, look, there was no mission organization here that we said, hey, put this trip together for us. We've kind of had to come up with this on our own. And so what I did is just, did some searching on the internet for local humanist or atheist or skeptic groups here in Southern California, and just started browsing their websites, finding links to other organizations, seeing if there's any events that they do locally. In fact, I think it's February 12th is National Darwin Day, where a lot of these organizations will do events in celebration of Darwin and his their view of his contributions to culture. And so seeing if we can piggyback on some of those events. But in the process, of course, I've been able to now find that here in Southern California, there's kind of a number of organizations, atheist organizations, humanist organizations that meet regularly, that maybe are thriving, that have a number of members. And so simply what I've done through their websites is contact them and say, look, here's what we're doing. We're a group of Christians who want to interact with you. We want to have some conversation. We want to hear your arguments. I mean, this kind of an we give them an invitation, say, look, we've got a group of Christians here that want to hear why you're not a Christian. What are your best arguments against Christianity? And would you be interested in doing that? And what we found is that the response is overwhelmingly positive. A lot of times they'll say, absolutely. In fact, I discovered a website called skeptoid.com, and this is a guy who's local to Southern California. And so I simply emailed him, and he's actually done through his website, I was able to see that he does presentations kind of, I think, on the side and speaks to atheist groups but also to Christian groups. So I simply emailed him and said, hey, would you be willing to come to our church, to the Rising Tide? The church meets on a Saturday night. Would you be willing to come and speak to our church? And, of course, he was more than willing, and we've given him an hour to present. And specifically, we've kind of narrowed it down for him. He's going to do a presentation called Debating Creationists, and it's basically his case against creation. And then we said, hey, afterwards, can you do Q&A for an hour and a half – or, I'm sorry, for a half hour? So kind of block out hour and a half time. And so he's coming, and he's gonna do this presentation for our church. And, of course, we've done some training. The event itself we consider training. It's a way to prepare the people at Rising Tide to engage with these ideas. And to, here you go. You've got a real-life atheist right in front of you. Here's his arguments. How do we respond to this? And we're hoping, I'm hoping that we build a relationship with this guy, that maybe this is a guy, if he's close enough, that we can meet with on a regular basis and ultimately maybe have an impact in his life. And so that's just one of the things we're doing. We're planning on getting on a couple college campuses. We're hoping to get on the campus of the University of Irvine, California, UCI, and do some surveys with college students, and let our folks kind of create opportunities for them to interact with people who are not believers and who may come from, who knows, any kind of background, not just atheist. We're trying to partner with an atheist organization on UCI's campus and say, hey, look, let's do an event together where maybe we bring our church together with your atheist group here on campus, and let's sit down together in a classroom and have an hour of dialogue and interaction. Maybe break up into small groups where we talk about, why I'm a theist or why I'm an atheist. And these are opportunities to then engage and ultimately train our people, but then at the end of the day also to see opportunities maybe to present the gospel, build relationships with these folks where, of course, these things don't happen instantaneously. But maybe over a few years of developing these relationships and working with these folks, we may see God use that in their lives. So these are just some of the things that that we're trying to do to make this stuff practical, to really kind of take this stuff to the street, so to speak, and really engage. I mean, this is not just we're not just building up some kind of storehouse of knowledge that we don't want to employ, but no, we really want to ultimately get out there and engage those atheists with what we take to be the truth of Christianity, life-changing truth, eternal truth. And of course, like I said, this is something we just kind of done on our own. This is something anyone can do. If you are located somewhere near a college campus, then I can almost guarantee you there's a group on campus or there's a group around the campus that you can find. Just do a search on the web, do a Google search, and there's always on these websites usually a contact link where you can contact these groups. Even go and sit in on one of their meetings. Say, hey, I'm a Christian. I want to come sit in and talk with you guys or sit in on your presentations or your weekly or monthly group meetings. This is something that any of us can do. So I would encourage you to figure out ways that you can practically engage with these kind of ideas and not let them just kind of sit up there in the mind, but let's really engage on these things. All right. Well, we've got we've got some open lines here, and we're going to get to calls. We're going to take a quick break. But after the break, we're going to get to your calls. And if you are listening over the web, or if you are somewhere coast to coast here in the United States, give us a call at 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. If you are local here in Orange County, give us a call at 714-754-4150. That's 714-754-4150. Your calls right after this break. You're listening to Stand to Reason.
Human suffering poses the most difficult question anyone can ask about a God who is both good and powerful. Do you know how to respond to the presence of evil and suffering in the world? Are you struggling with this question personally and need some clear thinking on the issue? Are you doubting God's goodness or know someone that is? Let Greg help you think through this important question. Order the tape set, Three Tough Questions from Stand to Reason. You'll also get Greg's training on two other questions that many struggle with today, the heathen and the unknown God, and is one way the only way? You'll be equipped to answer three of the toughest questions leveled against Christianity by the time you've thoroughly gone through this material. Extensive notes are included for your study. Order today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or by visiting our website at www.str.org.
Tired of defending your faith with "the Bible says so," "does too," or "I think it does"? Do you remove yourself from conversations with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Stop being unprepared and call today for the latest issue of Solid Ground, the bi-monthly newsletter of Stand to Reason. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you articulate your faith and have a biblically grounded understanding of subjects like same-sex marriage, evolution, stem cell research, and partial birth abortion. Don't be embarrassed or unprepared when you stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kogel teaches you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive yet effective manner. Learn tactics tempered with wisdom that make your beliefs persuasive, not naive. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Ask for the latest copy of Solid Ground to be sent to you today. It's free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
You're listening to Stand to Reason. I'm Brett Kunkel, filling in for Greg. And the second hour, we are taking your phone calls. Give us a call, 1-800-227-5278, if you want to talk about religion, ethics, values, whatever's on your mind. 1-800-227-5278, if you're close by here in Southern California. The number is 714-754-4150. Let me just announce, starting tomorrow night, we've got our Master Series in Christian Thought. Don't miss that at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. 7 o'clock to 9:30, Frank Turek will be kicking that off with a talk entitled, "I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist." And so we hope to see you there. We're going to go ahead and go to the phone lines. Casey from Salt Lake City, welcome to the show.
Hi, Brett Kunkel. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Casey?
Great. Doing great. Happy birthday to Paige.
Hey, you know what? I doubt she is listening at this point, but I appreciate the sentiments, and I'll pass those along
Great.
To her.
Great. Well, let me jump right into it, if you don't mind. I'm kind of glad, you know, Frank's not on the line, because, you know, he's made tons of assumptions here, and, you know, I don't want to get – I sort of think he'd be embarrassed by some of the claims that he's making, because he's – I mean, I was originally prepared to – pick apart Frank's points, you know, one by one.
Okay.
But your call screener said I can only really choose one. So hopefully you want to keep me on the show longer. But the one thing that he kind of said was, you know, the Bible is the Word of God, and you can go through it in four steps: truth, God, mm-hmm. miracles, and New Testament.
Yeah, that's kind of logical progression of his argumentation.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. What I wanted to do was, yeah, I agree with there is objective truth. Everyone has to agree with that. But what he says that there is a God, he assumes that there's like a personal God. He doesn't account for the existence of like a deist, for example, who like James Monroe, Thomas Jefferson, Spinoza, Albert Einstein. These people all believe that there is a God, but they don't say that there's a personal God.
Okay,
so, you know.
Well, let me say this. Let me jump in here, Casey, real quick, and then we'll continue to dialogue. But you say Frank assumes lots of things, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work or if you've read his book. But of course, in less than a 60-minute interview, we had about 40 minutes or so to speak. Of course, we're going to blow through his case pretty quickly.
Sure.
But if you look at his material and if you've heard Frank do his presentation, he doesn't actually just assume these kinds of things. He actually makes an argument for them.
Well, I mean, I'm basing that on like I mean, he gets a lot of his work from you know people like F.F. Bruce and Josh McDowell and Greg Boyd and Coco, whatever. You know, I mean, I've read Lee Strobel and all those books, and so. I mean, these are all common arguments, so it really doesn't matter, you know, if he's making them or somebody else is making them. These are very common.
Right, but he's not simply assuming them, because that was actually in our discussion. I mean, that's one of the things we were raising against atheists, assuming naturalistic assumptions. But that's fine. So you know, he makes an argument for God's existence, and I think Frank would, and I would, of course, distinguish between a deistic view of God and, of course, Christian theism and a Christian theist view of God. But I think either way, whether you're a deist or a Christian theist, you can make an argument. You don't simply have to assume God's existence. You can make an argument for God's existence.
Sure, and that's why he says cosmological, teleological, and moral.
Right, and so
you know, but he doesn't. He doesn't feel. He fails to even you know in the cosmological argument, he fails to say who caused God. You know, and then in the you know in the teleological argument, he says, oh, you know, people. You know, he doesn't. He just assume. I won't use the word assumed, but he says that nobody knows. He says that the atheist doesn't know basically that, you know, the origin of the universe. Well, you know, I don't think you guys know either. And then he says the moral.
The theist is going to respond. No, we do know the cause of the universe. The cause of the universe is God.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. And so now, this is not just, merely assumed. Again, we're making an argument here, and there's an argument for.
I don't use the word assume anymore. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we're going to make an argument for God's existence. And of course, yes, you can raise the objection has been raised in this kind of a classical objection. Well, who caused God? And I think there's a number of things.
Yeah, there's a bunch of work related to it. We could debate this for a couple hours. But,
well, let's deal with that because I think it's an important question. And in my engagements with atheists, this is kind of a common objection that comes up: who caused God?
Sure.
And I think there's several things that we could say to this. Number one, in the cosmological argument, you have to remember that the theist is not claiming that everything needs a cause. Okay.
Yeah.
The theist in the cosmological argument is claiming that all events need causes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's not that everything that in the universe that exists needs a cause. It's mm-hmm. that all events need causes. And so here's the dilemma. If all events need causes, you trace this back, and part of the cosmological argument is that you make an argument that it's impossible for there to be an infinite amount of past events,
uh-huh.
right? If there's an infinite amount of past events, well, there's a number of problems with that, but you ultimately would not arrive at this present event, right? There's this event taking place right now of you, Casey, talking to me on the phone, okay? Now, there was an event that preceded this event. That was you maybe picking up the phone and calling in, and then, of course.
Yeah.
Now, if that series runs infinite, if that's an infinitely long series in the past, well, then we would never arrive at this point where you and I are actually talking on the phone. But here we are talking.
And that's a larger question of is there an infinity before us? And that's really not even a question. I mean, it kind of deals with God, but not really. I mean,
in the cosmological argument, we're gonna argue against the idea that there can be an infinite amount of past events, and therefore. There must have been a beginning to the universe.
Okay, but see, you also claim that events are always have a cause, right?
Yeah, that's the claim.
Well, I think scientists have proven that, like in black holes, there are events that take place that do not have a cause, and there's no way you can even determine that. So we've even proven scientifically that that's not true.
Okay, well,
and so I hear these kind of arguments all the time, and I try and But, you know, like I said,
well,
I
well,
don't
let, let me you got that,
I really
that
don't.
You've got
you
that
know,
kind
I mean,
of black hole thing hanging out there. Let me address that real quickly, because that's actually not the case that science has shown that events don't have causes. In fact,
the black hole, they do.
There will
I can find a Wikipedia article on it right now.
Well, Wikipedia is probably not the best resource for these kinds of things.
Okay, I won't trust the encyclopedia
there,
but yeah.
I mean, you maybe I'll find some decent information there, but even if a scientist doesn't, they may not know how certain events are caused. But the lack of knowledge about the cause doesn't follow, therefore, that they don't have any causes, okay? And I've looked at some of this, and science, there is absolutely no scientific consensus on the – really, usually the objection from scientists comes at the quantum level. They'll say you've got these quantum events, and we don't –
That's why Albert Einstein didn't believe in God, yeah.
Yeah, at the quantum level, we have these events where we just don't know what the cause is, or they're kind of uncaused. But first of all, there's no scientific consensus on that. That's kind of a relatively new field. But then I think we can also respond to this in several other ways. Now, I made a distinction, right? The cosmological argument says that that no events have cause, or all events have causes. But that's not the only kind of causation that we observe in the world, right? We see events causing other events, but there's another kind of causation, and that is what we call agent causation. So, for instance, let's say I have a 13-year-old daughter, okay? I walk into her room. I notice that the room is a mess. Clothes are everywhere. School books are everywhere. There's just things everywhere. And so I look at my daughter, my 13-year-old daughter, and I say, Lexi, what happened to this room? Right, I'm seeking a cause. What is the best explanation for the state of this room? And she can appeal to one of two types of causation, either event causation or agent causation. So if she appeals to an event, she may say something like, "Well, Dad, didn't you feel the earthquake? There was a huge earthquake, and all my clothes came flying out of their drawers, and that's why this room's such a mess." So that's a possible cause, right? The event causation. But there may be a better explanation, and that might be the causation of an agent, a personal agent, who would be her, right? It'd be my daughter, Lexi, who might say, "Well, Dad, I threw those clothes on the ground. I threw those books on the ground. I'm the best explanation here. I am the explanation." Okay, so those are the two kinds of causes.
Yeah, and hey, can you hear me, Brett?
Yeah, I can. Well, now
I got disconnected. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm back on. So, I missed part of that, but I caught what you were saying.
So sure. You've got these two kinds of causations. The theist is going to say no. It's event. All events need causes. I mean,
at the very least,
it seems counterintuitive for someone to say, "Hey, yeah, that event or this thing popped into existence out of uncaused out of nothing." Right? If you walk into a room and you see a billiard ball moving across a pool table, you're going to draw an inference, right, that there was some kind of cause.
Yeah,
it could be an event or an agent. It could be another billiard ball striking that moves it across the table, or it could be an agent, someone striking that ball with a cue, a human being doing that. And so what the theist then in the cosmological argument is making an appeal to is agent causation, and so that there is an agent that through his own will is able to bring about the beginning of the universe. Now, of course, we know that the thing that precedes the beginning of the universe, it can't itself be an event, or you still have the problem of an infinite regress, right?
Yeah.
And if we're able to argue that an infinite regress is not a good way to go, it doesn't seem to be a good argument, and that there has to be a beginning of the universe. Well, the question is, if there's a beginning, there's got to be a beginner. What is the best explanation for that beginner? Well, an event won't do. And so the only other explanation you've got is an agent. Now, of course, that agent is going to have to be it's going to be timeless, spaceless, changeless. It's going to have sufficient power an intelligence to bring a universe, you know, out of nothing? And this seems
well, that
to
could be. But even if there was, and even if there are miracles, that says nothing about the New Testament, because if it's a deistic God, it's not a personal God. Then it doesn't matter whether Jesus exists. You know, there's nothing else that matters.
Well,
he's not
sir,
personal. He doesn't.
Sure.
So just saying that there is a God doesn't prove that anything about miracles in the New Testament. And he made a logical progression there,
yeah.
And that's what I was saying that was you know a logical fallacy there.
Well, here's what you got to do, Casey. What you got to do is you've got to kind of here'd be my suggestion is maybe have. If you can, be a little patient with the argument and try and follow. Frank is trying to build a cumulative case here.
Yeah.
And there's not
and
one
like
magic
I said,
bullet.
I wanted to go through his points one by one and take care of them. And I can do that really quickly if you have some time. But
no, well, you know, I'd love to if we had more time. But we got to get
to
some.
We need just a whole show on this.
Yeah, we got to get to some other calls. But I want to make a case here because you're
can
kind
I
of your initial.
Can I say one more thing before I leave? He said that there was no serious scholarship that doesn't think Jesus existed. And so, and I wanted to give a few scholars that do think that Jesus didn't exist.
Okay, go ahead and throw
those out. One is Dr. Bob Price and one is Acharya S., both of whom have written books like The Incredible Shrinking Son of Man, you know, several books that they're both PhD. I know Bob Price is a PhD in theological seminary, so I don't think he can make that claim that there's no serious scholarship that doesn't think that Jesus didn't exist. There's
yeah.
tons of people that don't think that.
Well,
there actually are
not tons, and the atheists who make that argument themselves will admit that they are actually in the minority, and the most of the atheists. Most atheists out there, or most scholars in general, will concede that at the very least that Jesus existed. So this is a minority position, and yeah, you can maybe throw out one or two people with PhDs who have written books on it, but that doesn't mean that this is kind of an overwhelming amount of scholarship out there on this. And so this is actually a minority view. And even when you look at secular scholars, non-Christian scholars, serious scholars, the consensus is clearly that Jesus existed. And so there's a huge burden of proof, I think, on the atheists to deal with this. Well, Casey, hey, Casey from Salt Lake City, thanks for your call. I enjoyed interacting with you. And hey, call back again. Maybe next week, and we'll interact more. We're going to take a little break and come back and take more of your calls. So if you are, if you want to talk or talk about issues of life, philosophy, morality, religion, ethics, values, give us a call. Coast to coast, the number is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. If you're close by here in Southern California, the number is 714-754-4150. That's 714-754-4150. More of your calls after the break here on Stand to Reason.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel, letting you know that Stand to Reason is back with an unmatched cruise conference experience featuring some of the top Christian thinkers in the country. On August 2nd, 2008, we'll set sail from Vancouver, BC for 8 days aboard one of Holland America's finest cruise ships. We're planning a voyage you'll never forget. It's specifically designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. Here's our plan. We want to challenge you with thoughtful presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction and fellowship with expert speakers and fellow passengers. Add to that the stunning splendor of the Alaskan coastline and a 7-day itinerary that includes Glacier Bay, Skagway, Juneau, and Ketchikan. I'll be joined by some of our distinguished guest speakers, Josh McDowell, J.P. Moreland, and Sean McDowell. Come and join Stand to Reason and our lineup of speakers for a memorable spiritual adventure. You'll enjoy plenty of fun and relaxation, along with ample opportunity to meet our speakers, ask questions, and enjoy each other's company. Listen, if studying Christian subjects with some of the sharpest minds on the planet in the fellowship of other believers of kindred spirit aboard a beautiful ship sailing the Alaskan coastline sounds like your idea of a perfect vacation, then this is the trip for you. As always, you don't need any prior understanding of the subject matter. Simply bring desire to learn in a relaxing environment. We planned everything about this trip with your enjoyment and your enrichment in mind. But don't just take my word for it. Visit STR.org and see what other guests of Stand to Reason have said about past STR cruises. Save the dates, download the brochure from STR.org, and then contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. They're helping us with our trip, and their skilled staff are committed to answering all your questions. I look forward to seeing you on board.
All right, folks, welcome back. You are listening to Stand to Reason. I'm Brett Kunkel, student impact speaker here at Stand to Reason, filling in for Greg, who is down under in Australia and doing some great work with Summit Ministries. We've got open lines this second hour, and we want you to give us a call, give us a piece of your mind, give us a call coast to coast. The number is 1-800-227-5278, 1-800-227-5278. If you're close by here in Orange County, the number is 714-754-4150. That's 714-754-4150. Before we get to our next call, I just want to mention again our Master Series in Christian Thought, which is happening tomorrow night, kickoff lecture with Frank Turek, who's my guest the first hour. He's doing a talk called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. That's 7 o'clock to 9:30 at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. We hope to see you there tomorrow night for the kickoff of that great series. All right, we're going to take more of your calls here. And so I want to go to Sarah. You're in Chicago. Welcome to the show, Sarah. Sarah, are you there? Well, we're trying to bring you up. I think we're having a... Well, looks like we may have lost Sarah. Or we're going to try... Are we going to try and bring her back up? Okay. Well, I think we're going to work on that. And Sarah, let's see, if you're not on.
Hello?
I think I'm getting you. Is
that Hello, Brett?
Sarah, yes.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Hey, I'm glad we got you plugged in here. Welcome to Stand to Reason.
Thank you. My husband and I have been trying to conceive for about a year and a half now, and we were just diagnosed as being infertile. Mm. My question was, how far should a Christian couple go as far as like infertility treatments and testing before they overstep their moral boundary?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a big question, and actually, it's kind of a personal question to us here at Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, our president, and I think he shared some of this over the. I don't know if he's talked about this over the radio. I'm sure he has. He's talked about. Some of their attempts to have children. Of course, for those of you who know, Greg has adopted two children, and so for couples, of course, who are infertile, adoption is a of course that's a wonderful opportunity, and mm-hmm. And there does not seem to be any moral questions there. Now, when it comes to some of the reproductive technologies. That are out there. That's where some of the questions are raised. And you know, first of all, not all of these issues are black and white. And I think that's one thing that we have to kind of approach some of these issues with is the idea that when it comes to some of this reproductive technology, we want to give it our best thought, and we don't want to necessarily find kind of a or we may not necessarily find. A kind of this clear line in the sand, because there's certainly even within the Christian community and amongst Christian thinkers or theologians or philosophers, there's some disagreement on maybe where a particular line is drawn. And so you've got some different technologies. You've got in vitro fertilization. You've got artificial insemination, and surrogate motherhood. These kinds of things. Now, I think here are let me throw this out, and Sarah, we can interact on this. But here are maybe some of the questions to think about when it comes to the reproductive technologies. Here would be a first question. Number one, should we interfere in a natural process. And I think for I think this would be kind of a concern that many Catholic theologians have. Mm-hmm. If there's there's kind of this an appeal to kind of creation and kind of the natural progression of creation. Now, I'm not sure if we can make an argument. I'm not sure if we can make what we call a normative argument from that. I think we have to be careful about, from that alone, saying, hey, well, this is kind of, we can't bring any reproductive technologies into the equation. So that's one question to think about. But another one might be if in our reproductive technologies, are we using maybe a third-party contributor to procreation? So, like when it comes to artificial insemination, you've got a third-party contributor. And now, again, I don't know if scripturally we're going to be. I don't think we're going to be able to make a kind of a knockdown, drag-out argument on this one. But there is maybe concerns about maybe a disconnection in the procreative process for maybe one of the members of a couple. And so, say it's a husband who is not able to reproduce, and so of course you have a kind of a donor who of course donates the sperm. Is there? I think the couple's going to really have to think carefully about how does the removal of the husband from that process affect the husband and the wife. Mm-hmm. Are there going to be issues maybe that are potential issues there with the maybe a kind of a biological disconnection that the husband has with the child? So maybe it's the wife's genetic material, but it's not the husband's, and so there are those kinds of issues I think to think about when it comes to something like artificial insemination. When it comes to in vitro fertilization, again, I don't think there's a in principle argument that we can draw on that says no, that the line is here you can't do IVF. In fact, of course, Greg, who Steese and he have gone down that road, and so I don't think in and of itself IVF is problematic, but I think that in that process, there are things that you do have to consider. Mm-hmm. And so with IVF, one of the things you're going to have to consider is the possibility of leftover embryos, right? There's kind of this creation of a number of embryos. Sometimes the doctor will suggest a certain amount. Mm-hmm. And I think Greg and Steese were very careful in terms of how many they – Now, I could be wrong on this, and so maybe Melinda can correct me if I'm wrong on this. But I think for Greg and Steve, they were only going to create those embryos in which they were going to implant. And so in this whole process, they weren't going to create, 20 embryos and then kind of choose the best five and then have this problem of these leftover embryos. But every embryo that was created was going to be implanted. And so, that's one of the issues that we have to take into consideration when it comes to IVF. How many embryos are going to be created, and if you do have leftover embryos, what kind of problems does that provide? What do we do with those? Because of course, on our view, life begins at conception, and so you've got tiny human life there. That is just as valuable as you or I, and of course there are some other options in terms of maybe adopting embryos out. But anyway, that's one of the considerations in IVF, and you'll have to. I mean, there are probably questions that you're going to have to ask specifically about the particular lab. And maybe what they do with leftover embryos, if there's cost involved in storing those, I think limiting the number of eggs fertilized, if I think that would be one key consideration, and so I think those are some of the issues that would come into play as we think about some of these reproductive technologies. So I don't see a clear black and white issue, but I think we need to think through if we do create embryos, what do we do with the leftover embryos? I mean, I almost don't even like using the word leftover because you're talking about human and precious human life. You've got to think about in the procreative process. If one or one of the members of the couple, you know, one of the spouses is not, they're not contributing any genetic material to that. How does that impact, how does that impact both of them? I mean, so there's kind of some of these deep issues to deal with, and it's not always black and white as you're considering those. So I don't know if that helps you with some of the thinking through that. Does that help, Sarah?
Yes, definitely. I guess my biggest question was whether or not it was okay to go through with some testing, or should we just let God decide when to give us a baby? That kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I think if you can determine that the technology that you're looking at is not in question morally. So if we look at IVF, in vitro fertilization, we can say, okay, given these certain considerations, it's not immoral to go ahead with that. Well, then certainly I think that you can go ahead with the test. Now, you kind of set up a kind of a distinction between going forward with the testing for a certain technology. And then on the other side, you've got, well, should we wait for God to give us a child? And I think I know what you mean. Should we, of course, the doctors, say that we're not going to be able to have children naturally together. But, of course, you always hear those stories of miracles where, a couple has a child after the doctors told them it's just not possible, after whatever, a few years or 4 or 5 or 6 years. And so that's kind of maybe viewed as, well, that God gave us that child. But I think that maybe that's kind of a false distinction, because I think through technology, maybe through some, through the wonderful work that that some scientists have done, who have given us the opportunity to do something like IVF, that can also be the process that God uses to give you the child. Do you see what I'm saying? And so I don't think it's, well, I either wait for God to give me a child for me to, get pregnant with my husband, or I go in and try IVF kind of on my own. I think the IVF, if we say, look, this doesn't break God's moral law, that may be the means that God uses to provide a child for you. And so, again, personally, I don't have a problem with IVF in principle. I think there are some considerations mm-hmm. as you go through that process. But so I would say, yeah, if you look through the issues carefully on your own, and you come to the conclusion that yeah, IVF's okay. Well, then I think certainly you can go through with that testing, and at the same time trust that God is going to work through that, and that child that is provided through IVF is from Him, just as if you and your husband were able to get pregnant on your own.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so that may be the means that God uses. Of course, if we were talking about in a moral means, then we would say, of course, that would not be the means that God uses if we were to say that that was immoral. You know what, Sarah, if you will hold on, there's some resources I think that we want to point you to. In fact, you can go to our website also at str.org and find out more. I believe we have some stuff up there about in vitro fertilization. I know Greg and also Steve Wagner, I think, has written some stuff on that. And so if you go to our website, you can find out more. Hopefully I've been able to kind of give you some things to think about when it comes to that. But hold on there, Sarah, and the enforcer will give you some more possibilities. All right, we want to move on to the next call, Lewis from Puerto Rico. Welcome to Stand to Reason, Lewis.
Hi, Brett.
Good to hear from you in Puerto Rico. Where in Puerto Rico are you?
I'm in Caguas, Puerto Rico. That's south of San Juan, which is the capital.
Okay, yes. What's your question, Lewis?
Yeah, I had a question about suicide, and more specifically pertaining to a person that is saved or considered saved because of an experience that we had 3 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we had this person in church who, of course, you would consider saved, and about 3 months ago, she committed suicide.
Mm.
She shot herself in the car and left a letter saying that the reason why she did it was because her husband converted to Islam, and she couldn't live with that, so killed herself.
Wow.
And so that created a stir in the church, and people started questioning a bunch of stuff. So on the Protestant side, I have people saying, well, of course, Jesus paid for all our sins, including the future ones, which is why I believe as a born-again Christian. But then on my parents' side, when I told them the story, they were saying, no, that's a mortal sin, which is distinct from a venial sin in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And since it wasn't forgiven because she killed herself, she's pretty much going to hell.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I just wanted to pick your mind on that argument and see what you could tell me about that.
Yeah, well, I guess here's kind of how I address this, Lewis. What is the basis for our salvation? The basis of our salvation is not in any... it's not in anything we can do, right? I mean, you've got clear passages in Scripture. I mean, you don't have any clear passages in Scripture that deal with the issue of suicide. So I think we're going to kind of have to come at this. There's not a kind of a proof text that we can point to in Scripture that says this is what the Bible says about suicide. So we're going to kind of come about this in a roundabout way. But our basis for salvation is not in our actions, right? There's no meritorious effort that we can produce that brings salvation. Salvation is a free gift from God. Of course, that classic passage, Ephesians 2, 8 and 9, lays it out very clearly, right? That we are saved through grace by faith. It's not on the basis of our works. And so if indeed this gal, I mean, this is tragic, but if indeed she was a Christian who then commits suicide, but she's been saved on the basis not of her works, but of placing her trust in Christ. Then I think that that she is she's indeed someone we will see again in heaven, because the basis is not. I don't think she can commit. I don't think there's if she's truly a Christian, and of course. We may find indications, you know, whether it was in the fruit of her life or her professions, faith, what have you. There may be evidence that she was a Christian. Ultimately, God's a judge on that, and He truly knows the heart. But if she was indeed a Christian, there is no act, and she's saved on the basis of her salvation is not in anything that she has done. But it's the cross of Christ. It's grace alone. Then there is no work that that she can do to lose that, even if it is something as horrible as suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if we look at kind of, I think if we have a solid biblical foundation for salvation and what salvation is, it's not dependent upon anything that we can do, then it seems to me that it follows that there's nothing we can do to forfeit that. There's no action that we can take, even something as tragic as suicide, to forfeit our salvation.
Because I was telling my mom, when I was trying to explain to her pretty much what you just said, I was saying, well, if you go ahead and say that you go to hell because of suicide, then it almost presents it as more of a sin than lying, and then you start getting into the categorization of sins, which I'm kind of iffy about. I mean,
yeah, I think you're saying we can lose our salvation. Someone can lose their salvation on the basis of something that they can do. Well, of course, they never received that salvation on the basis of anything they can do. Well, thanks for the call, Lewis. Hopefully that gives you a little bit of help on that question. Well, friends, this has been a great 2 hours. I've been glad to be with you here on Stand to Reason. I want to encourage you to be intentional this week about being an effective ambassador for Christ. And of course, that being an effective ambassador for Christ with knowledge, wisdom, and character. And let's go out there and outthink and outlive this culture for the cause of Christ. I'm Brett Kunkel for Stand to Reason.